for the last time at Sunderland Education Centre. Phil White, take it away.
I'll be doing an episode next Tuesday. This is Contingency FM.
So sad today.
That was haunting.
Well, it's a sad day.
That was haunting.
Is it?
Yeah. It's a Friday in the middle of July and there's a thunderstorm tonight.
It's also June, but...
yeah, but... what I'm saying is that when we release this episode in a few weeks, it probably will be a Friday in July. Probably won't be. In today's episode, we're going to continue our discussion on careers by discussing how we prepared for specialty applications and interviews. So once again, I think we're going to take a format of chatting through individually our experiences. I think it's quite nice we have quite a range of experience here. So first question, how did you start looking into applying? Why don't we go around? So start with yourself, Abby.
Okay, so I knew quite early on that I wanted to do obs and gynae. So I decided to look on the Royal College of Obs and Gynae website because I thought that was probably quite a good place to start. And they had loads of information on there. They had the person specification that I needed to look at to give me a bit of an idea about what I needed to think about for application, and they were a really good resource. I didn't really look at much else because I was quite set on that. So yeah, I think from my point of view, I'd say the Royal Colleges of whatever specialty you're interested in would be a really good place to start.
Mine was very similar because I knew I wanted to do PEDS. I looked on the RCPCH website, found the personal spec, found the dates, and just sort of went from there, because like you, Abby, I knew what I was going into.
I think for me, I wanted to do surgery, and the main source of information was other colleagues. So I just started speaking to the registrars and SHOs who had been through the process recently, and they were quite good for just getting the initial information about telling me how to start getting my portfolio together, what kind of activities I might have to, you know, do or might want to think about doing before applying. And then after that, it was just Googling, to be honest, looking at different websites, blogs, because I think you can get all the black and white information, you know, all the standard information, but I actually quite like that personal experience and those like nuanced pieces of advice that you can find online. So that's what I did.
Quite similar to you in terms of finding information from other people. I think most of the information I found is probably word of mouth, which whilst you might get a bit more of a piecemeal experience in terms of sort of not necessarily getting all the information in one place, you often get a lot more depth and practical advice, and you might hear about opportunities that you've not heard before. So I would recommend that, especially if you see someone doing a role which isn't standard, like a research post or like an SAS doctor or something, then chat to them about their career path, to chat to them about how they got there. You'll probably find out something you didn't know. That's where I heard about the ACF.
I agree that it's a really good idea to talk to people. I didn't think wanting to do medicine, I didn't think anyone really talked to me ever about applying to CMT, which is now IMT, because people tend to talk about applying for like specialty training and the reg jobs. So I just Googled it, and there's a Health Education England website that's got all the person specifications on. So I looked at that and was a bit undecided between, at the time, what was CMT and is now IMT, and doing acute medicine ACCS training. So I printed both specifications off on a night shift where there was a couple of hours with nothing to do, and went through and highlighted them and looked at the similarities, so that I kind of made sure that the extra things I was doing to make my application look good were applicable to both, because I hadn't decided yet what I was going to apply for.
So let's talk a bit about what kind of things you needed to do before you applied for your positions. Phil, do you want to start us off? What did you need to get done before you applied for GP?
So I actually discovered this quite late, because I as I said, I didn't really use the official, so I didn't look on the website, so I should have really done that.
He's a maverick.
But I realised quite late that GP don't have an application to do, really. I mean, it's I kept on expecting like they're going to turn around at some point and be like, where's your portfolio?
Yeah.
So it's like, I don't believe you. But genuinely, they do not have a portfolio you need. I actually kept and maintained one and kept one up because I was debating for a very long time whether I was going to do IMT. So I did kind of, I was aware of the things you need, the hoops you need to jump through and sort of trying to build a portfolio on the sly.
On the DL.
On the DL. Mm. But I guess sort of, yeah, the GP, the only thing you need to prep for is the exam, which disappointingly if you do well, but really good if you don't do well, has no further bearing on what kind of jobs you get in GP training. It's kind of,
it can save you an interview as well.
Yeah, it can save you an interview. If you do well on it, it saves you an interview. So if you don't like interviews, then you can just do well on your exam. I guess that's the best thing about it. And then for the ACF, there was quite a rigorous application process for that, which I guess I'll chat about more. That kind of comes into the interview and application form bit, but I'm sort of, that was more just answering questions and why I was interested in research and what kind of research things I'd already done.
And for the uninitiated, just tell us what ACS is.
The uninitiated. There's not part of the special club. No. So ACF is an academic clinical fellowship, and it is like academic foundation post, but for specialty training.
Wonderful. Or for core training.
Or for core training. Yeah. So it's like, if you're someone who has done an academic foundation post, you may want to consider doing an academic clinical fellowship. But if you haven't done a academic foundation post, don't worry, you haven't missed out. I didn't do an academic foundation post.
And yet here you are.
And yet here I am. So it's not the end of the world if you haven't. It just have to maybe be a bit more wise about trying to gather some research experience. But taking an F3 year to do that is really good.
Phil, you said you had to do an exam before you applied. That's the MRSA, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Abby, you had to do that too, right?
Yes, and I did not realise that I was going to have to do that. So it was, that was new for, I did it, by the way. So that sounds like I was like, I didn't know how to do it. No, I did it. But that's kind of one thing that, so I, the way that I prepared for my application was, like I said, looking through the person's specification, which is really important. But things change quite quickly sometimes between years for application. So the MSRA, was it MSRA?
MRSA is a
bacteria.
Methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, which is, you shouldn't get that.
Thanks, Professor White.
Thank you for educating us all. to be honest, I barely even knew what it was called. That's how prepared I was for it. So I didn't realise. So my friend who'd applied the year before did not have to do that for obs and gynae. And then for my year, we did. So it's really important to keep kind of abreast of changes between years, because that kind of took me a little bit by surprise. I mean, I'd been planning for, like, I knew I wanted to do obs and gynae, so I'd been keeping an eye on the person spec for a while. So I think I found out probably about, I don't know, 6 months before or something, so it was fine. It has different weighting for different specialties as well. So for me, I don't think it made up too much. It made up like 25% of my application. The majority was the interview anyway. I kind of mainly prepped by making sure that, because I knew quite early on I wanted jobs in gynae, I made sure that I had some form of foundation post in it so that I could get experience of it, but also kind of get stuff done for application as well.
What kind of things did you want done?
So I knew from the person specification that audit and quality improvement is a massive thing for demonstrating commitment to specialty in obs and gynae. So they really like you to have audits, really like you to complete cycles of audits and things
like
that.
How can you make your audit or your sort of that stand out or sparkle?
Sparkle. I don't know how much mine sparkled. I knew that I wanted to get an audit done, so I kind of said that immediately once I got into the into my F1 job. I was saying to you guys before, I had like a list of things I wanted to achieve because I was a massive nerd, and audit was like top of that. And I kind of spoke to some of the consultants about it, and one of them had an audit that was kind of ongoing. I could help data collect and then collate all the data, and I really pushed to present it because that's one way to make your audit sparkle. So I wanted to present it, so I presented it at the regional kind of audit meeting, and I also presented it. I like looked for different places that I could send it off to. So I presented it at like internationally, and it was the ARCOG like World Congress thing. So I presented I sent it off there, and there was like a poster presentation and stuff. So, but I just looked for opportunities basically, and looked for different, because there's lots of meetings all the time for loads of different specialties. So it's just about being opportunistic really with stuff like
and
that.
I think it's also maybe being efficient with what you do as well, because.
Yeah.
I think if you've got one project, but you can tick multiple boxes with it, because not everyone has the time, especially
no.
if you're in a busy job, you haven't got the time to pursue multiple projects. And it is about, it's not playing the system, it's just being wise to the system. And so,
it's just being like clever about
yeah.
and efficient
so,
about
it. So you're not going to, if you have got something presented at a international meeting, then you're not going to score any more points for also presenting it at a regional or national meeting.
Exactly.
So there's no point investing lots of energy doing that unless you really care about the project and you think it needs to be shared for its own right. But if you're just doing it for the points, don't spend lots of time, money, resource presenting it elsewhere.
Katie, how about you for pediatrics?
I didn't feel like I did loads of prep for my application. It was the actual application form itself was very straightforward, a couple of short answer questions, so you had to kind of explain like your leadership experience and teaching experience. But it was nothing that I wasn't expecting. Actually the thing that was hardest for planning, for getting my application together, was making sure I could, I had my references sorted. because my F2 educational supervisor, I don't know if she's moved jobs or something, cannot get hold of her. But I needed what's a reference from my F2, so I had to sort of email all of my clinical supervisors, and one of them got back to me. But beyond that, it was fairly straightforward, because I'd been planning on PEDS for a little while. I think I'd been almost accidentally building up a bit of experience, so I had some of the kind of leadership roles from uni, because I was in president of PEDS society. I had plenty of teaching experience because I'd already done a whole teaching fellow year. So there was nothing in particular that I sort of sat down and tried to make sure that I had.
I don't think that I did very much to actually prepare. I think, similar to Abby, I think all I did was kind of made sure that I presented some of the stuff I'd done. I didn't do any of that at any conference or anything. I just presented two little things that I'd done at kind of so one was at the Obs and Gynae steering group. It was an audit into breastfeeding, and that was just kind of the trusts steering group. And then I did one at kind of like the trusts antibiotic steering group, I think it was called, as well. So it wasn't anything that I had to submit or anything I had to do. I just, because I'd done these audits, I emailed the people and said, can I come and present them to you, because I've looked at something in your department. And then made sure that I got some kind of record that I had done that. But that was probably the only thing that I kind of did extra. all of my jobs were medicine or A&E, so actually I was just kind of in the environment in which I was applying for things to anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't do anything. I didn't kind of do any extra work in order to apply.
Mm-hmm. I think I've had a bit of a different experience to you guys in that I definitely did choose certain paths, certain projects with the intention of using that on my application. So, for example, this teaching fellow year that I'm doing, it was very deliberate because I know that I would get the points not only for teaching but also for doing a degree in teaching, which are two separate elements of the surgical
mm-hmm.
application program. So a year like this scored me max points on both of them. So that's something to think about if you are maybe lacking on the teaching side, if you are interested in being a teaching fellow, but you can very easily get points for teaching just by getting involved in your local departmental teaching, med school teaching. If you've been teaching as part of a society, that's something that you can use. And what Jossie said about evidencing what you do is really important. So anything you've done in the past that you can get some sort of concrete evidence, some certificate, a letter, anything that you can show that you've been involved with something, that's what you need to keep a hold of.
Do they give you points for organising teaching? Cause it's the, having organised a programme of teaching, which you can do without having a teaching fellow job. I know people that have organised F1 teaching, for
mm-hmm.
example.
Mm-hmm.
But it's there's something about that organisation because it's like the next level.
Yeah.
If you do a teaching fellow job,
mm-hmm.
you'll almost definitely be able to get. Well, I suppose it depends a little bit on where you work and on your exact job role.
Mm.
But I don't think any of us wouldn't be able to say we've had some element of organising teaching.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Teaching.
But I guess on that note, if you're thinking about doing a teaching fellow post, it's really important to talk to the teaching fellows already in post to have a very good idea about what that post involves, because even in this region, Northern region, every single teaching fellow post at each trust is completely different to the next.
Yeah.
And some of them are much, much more hands-on.
Yeah.
They literally range from kind of 100% teaching, where you are in charge of teaching like the majority of the time, to where you have to, you're 30% teaching and you're selecting to teach a couple of sessions a week randomly.
And they may even just be sort of coming to deliver pre-planned sessions.
Yeah.
You might just be delivering it.
That was another attraction to this job, I think, because even though it's only 50% teaching, I was able to organise teaching programmes, but the other 50% of the job is clinical, so I was able to use that time to boost up my surgical portfolio, like my procedure log, which is another way to evidence commitment to specialty, which Abby was talking about, and it allowed me time to, you know, do projects and audits that didn't necessarily have to be surgical, but it just means that you can show your commitment to the specialty. And I think another easy way to show commitment to specialty for those of you who are still in medical school is by doing your elective in the field that you're interested in.
Yeah.
And usually with electives, they're quite good chances to get projects and short little presentations and stuff, which really go a long way in the portfolio.
So, yeah, because it was interesting that you were saying about points, because I know you guys have had different experience with points and portfolios and stuff. I've not had to, for obs and gynae, there's no kind of points system.
Mm.
But I don't know if it'd be interesting for you guys to kind of talk a little bit about what you had to evidence for your interview and what scored points and what didn't.
Yeah. And maybe just as a context, if someone's not looked into that, very brief overview of what the whole points system is about, if someone doesn't know what we're talking about.
Mm.
So for applying for IMT, there are different kind of categories. So, for example, if we stick with teaching, one of them is teaching, and you get a certain number of points if you've organised a teaching programme that's run over 3 months. You get a certain number of points if you've done a few sessions over a certain amount of time. You get a certain number of points for having ever done any teaching. But you've got those in kind of over seven different kind of categories, I think. So things like leadership, training and teaching, quality improvement, publications, presentations. I personally find it quite a depressing thing to do, because for IMT anyway, you have to go through and you have to be like, don't have a PhD, never presented, given a kind of international presentation, I've never had a publication.
Is it a bit like a beefed up version of when you apply for foundation? Because when you apply for foundation, you get some points for having like an extra degree, and you get some points for audit and research. Well, not audit, but you definitely for research.
If you've been published.
If you've been published, you get points, yeah.
I don't really remember doing
I think it is, but it's much more, it's as I say, beefed up. So it's like that, but there's much more ability to influence the outcome. I think by the time you get to choosing that in foundation, there's, you know, if you've not done, doing a degree beforehand is quite a big factor in that, for example, or doing well in med school beforehand is quite a big factor. So there's much more opportunity to do something about it.
Yeah, this is a lot more rigorous, isn't it? Your IMT and surgical.
And with the IMT one anyway, you have to, one of the stations in the interview, which I'm sure we'll talk about in more detail, but kind of is relevant here, you have to prove everything you've claimed points for.
Yeah.
So if you've organised a teaching session, and that should get you 5 points, but you have absolutely no evidence of that, you can't claim that, because the folder that you take with you on the day and you give to the people interviewing you has to prove your points, and they can deduct points from you.
Mm.
So they check it all.
So keep your certificates.
Absolutely.
As we said previously.
And chase up, if you go to a conference and you present there and they don't give you a certificate for it, chase them up.
Yeah,
like so. Hardcore in the weeks after, being like, right, I need my certificate, my certificate, and keep sending emails till you get it.
Yeah,
yeah.
I think most of you going for surgery will know that portfolio is a huge part of it, and it's kind of similar to what Jossie said. So you have all these different categories. So some of the main ones that I was thinking about is, do you have any additional degrees? Have you been on any courses such as ATLS or basic surgical skills? There's a whole list of them online. So just look through the courses and see if there's any that you can get done before your interview. There's things like leadership and management, teaching, not only giving teaching, but also having some training in teaching. So those are two separate categories. And then additional achievements, prizes, if you're one of the special clever ones. And then commitment to surgery is a big part of it. And I know there are some people who will sit MRCS, for example, before their interview, because that is extra points. You don't have to have passed it, you just have to show that you've tried it.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that needs to be evidenced in a portfolio. Some different specialties have like a limit of how many pages you can have in your portfolio. The surgical one, there's no limit. You'll see people coming with massive binders, and it's incredibly intimidating at interview. People have their like names embossed in gold, and then you might be like me and just have your little lever arch binder. And it doesn't matter as long as it's organized and it has the appropriate evidence in it.
So I did the IMT, it was the CMT interview to start with, but I've done it more than once because I decided not to go into it straight away. But the first time I did it, I just took my little folder. I didn't have anything in Polly Pockets because I just had the normal width dividers.
Yeah.
And the Polly Pockets made them stick out too far. Mm. And it was just a couple of centimetres high. And I got there and I was just absolutely intimidated, terrified by all the people with the beautiful embossed files.
Mm-hmm.
So the second year, and this was just to make me feel better,
mm-hmm.
I bought a nicer folder and I put everything in plastic pockets.
I thought you were going to say you got an embossed file then.
No, I didn't get
it.
No. It wasn't embossed, but I've got an extra wide one.
Nice.
So that I could get the extra wide dividers.
Yeah.
Very nice.
And I printed my presentations and my teaching bigger, so that it was like two sides a page rather than six.
Nice.
And it was entirely just to make me feel better, but it actually made quite a lot of difference
because I had
a folder that looked the same as everyone else's folder.
There you go.
There you go.
The beauty of only needing 12 pages for you.
The beauty of not needing a portfolio at all.
So in PEDS it's 12 pages and you guys don't have any at all for GP or OBS and GUM?
No.
So no, I'll let you talk about, because I was going to say mine, like me talking about my experience would probably be a quite good way to go into interview, because OBS and GYNE is all about interview.
Yeah.
You've got to, that's your main thing, so I'll let you.
I was going
to
say the same thing for ACF. So I'm there's really not much more to talk, if I was going to sit here and talk about GP application, there's really not more much more I could say apart from there's an exam, try and do well in it, if not there's an interview, and I don't know much about the interview because I've not done it.
I think it's just a selection centre. I've had a few friends do it and it's just kind of like similar to med school.
Yeah.
Like
chat to someone who's done it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's not. I don't think it's anything.
Do you
want to
talk first about obs and gyne then? Because it's maybe a good segue into sort of talking about interviews.
Yeah. Okay. So obs and gyne is all based around interviews. So we've got no portfolio that we take in with us. You don't have to provide any evidence for anything that you've done, which so it's you obviously based upon probity, but you. So like Phil was saying, you do your exam, and like I said, I think that's worth 25%. And then the rest of the interview is split into three stations. So the first one, well, you kind of circuit around them. My first one was a prioritisation station. So I just had to talk through like five different patients, and they were 15 minutes long. And I had to explain what I do with the patients and how I prioritise them. My second one was my interview station. So I kind of had a... that's where I spoke about myself basically, and just like told them everything that I'd done as quick as I could in 15 minutes. And then my third one was a communication station, so I had to do a difficult communication again in 15 minutes. And that is how I got my place. They score you, and you get the score sheets at the end.
Of the same day?
At the end of when you get your placement through,
right.
Then because you rank your jobs, and then when you get your job through, you get your score sheet back, which is helpful. Although I'm not gonna have an interview for another 7 years, so I don't know how helpful that'd be, but you know. But in my interview station, I mainly talked about, it was basically like an e-portfolio station, like you have an IMT, just no portfolio. So I talked about my audits, I talked about my commitment to specialty, so I talked about that I'd worked in New Zealand, that I'd worked here, that I'd got an obs and gyne teaching fellow job, I talked about the teaching I'd done, and I talked about like extracurricular stuff when I'd shown leadership, so everything that you guys needed to evidence I did touch on, and I made sure they kind of led the conversation, but I tried to kind of make my answers fit other person spec stuff as well. So they'd ask about kind of what I don't know, what placements have you had in obs and gyne, and I was like, oh well, I had my F1 placement, and I within that I did an audit, and I did this, and I did that, and I presented there, and I also did worked in New Zealand and that, but yeah, and just kind of tried to tailor my answers to try and fit as much as possible, because 15 minutes is not really a long time.
It goes past
to,
very quickly.
Yeah, it goes past super quick, and it's not a long time to sell yourself to about a specialty you want to do for the rest of your life. So yeah, that was my interview experience. I had to go to Manchester because it was all centralised, and it was very rainy. That was my main takeaway from the day.
Apart from the rain, mine sounds fairly similar to yours, actually. I think it was a fairly nice day. We started with a prescribing station. So they sat down, there were four stations, and so four of us doing it at the same time. So they had us all in the same room, we did a quick prescribing task, and then they moved us on to the stations. So we had, I'm definitely going to forget one, a communication station, where it's just a communication scenario and you get marked on it, kind of interview what you why do you want to do pediatrics, and in that's when you had the 12 pages of your portfolio. So you had two interviewers, you handed your portfolio to one of them, the other one asked you some questions about why you wanted to do it and what experience you had, and then they checked your portfolio, and because you can only bring 12 pages, you have to be very selective, and it has to be sort of the 12 pages that best represent you and what you've done, which involved things like I wanted to show an audit, so I just included the introduction and method, or maybe just the introduction and then the discussion and conclusion of the audit, made it the font really small and the margins really wide so it fit on one page rather than six. The writing wasn't tiny, that would be silly. Or like photocopy two pages of a booklet so that it was then on one page, just so I had the 12 pages. Then we had an acute acute station where you basically talked through ABCDE, but they didn't give you any feedback. You'd sit and go, I would check and see if they have a patent airway, and if they wouldn't, then I would. And you know, I think I rambled about airway adjuncts for about 3 minutes.
Yeah. I just said a lot of things to two blank faces.
Yeah.
For 15 minutes. I'd then do an ABG.
Then they
and they'd just be like, they just silence. I was like,
you're kind of expecting maybe some results
or
maybe some signs. I'll just carry on talking.
Yeah.
And then the last one, oh, that was it. It was clinical governance. So you had to discuss, they gave us like a scenario and you had to discuss what you would do, and it was all to do with, I think it was a baby had been given the wrong express breast milk. So you had to talk about apologising and complaint procedures and things like that. And they asked you a couple of questions, but it was fairly straightforward. That was the kind of big one that you could prepare for.
Am I right in thinking there was a prescribing task for peas?
Yeah, right at the beginning. It wasn't worth it. So each station was worth 40 marks, I think, and the prescribing was worth 10.
Mm.
But it was really, really straightforward.
Mm.
You had a BNFC and you just prescribed it.
Yeah.
If you know how to sign your name and look up a drug, you'll probably be okay.
That's good to know.
So for the ACF interview, I think that it's a much less standardised in the sense of, I think the reason why there's such a high sort of point system with very sort of specific stations almost for the other interviews is because they're trying to get large numbers of people through in a very equitable way. And then the ACF ones, they still have points, but it's just one panel and you ask, this takes about half an hour, there's about 7 or 8 questions. All the questions tend to be the same. Now I'm saying it is really standardised, but in a different way. It's in a different way to the other ones. Again, I did actually bring a portfolio of everything I'd done, but they didn't ask for it or look for it, and it wasn't necessary.
They didn't want it.
No, but I felt I didn't want
Sorry.
It.
Sorry, Phil.
Is it just like a little safety blanket?
Yeah, I think it was more just like, I think to sit there, the process of amalgamating it was helpful for me in working out what have I done and how can I, and also I think it will be useful for the future, because otherwise you can lose track of stuff so quickly and forget about important stuff you've done really, really easily. And so I think it's for me almost to start of something later rather than necessarily useful then. I looked up, so the ACFs have all the questions in the mark scheme are online. You can look them up on the
NIHR website.
Yes, the NIHR website. Do look at those. I looked them up a few weeks in advance and then I prepped my answers and practiced almost daily for 3 weeks. I think that was massively helpful. It was quite a lot of commitment, but I really wanted the job. So,
fair enough.
It worked because I think when I got there, even when they brought in a question that I hadn't prepped before, because I knew what I was talking about. And I am one to ramble, if you haven't noticed already.
No.
I know it's a shock to you, but I can say something with 20 words when it could be said with 2.
You just did it then.
Exactly. I ramble. I could say something. Yeah, there we go. And so it was really helpful for me just to be more concise. The two things which were most helpful for me in that were, number one, going back to my GCSE English, a piece of advice my English teacher gave me, which was to PEE all over your work. Point, evidence, explanation.
Oh, I was like, that's a
and
different type of advice to what I got.
But it's the same as the advice which you get when you to do a good reflection. Keep the description to a minimal and evaluate and explain what you're doing. So try and rehearse how to get through selling what you've done as quickly as possible so you can get onto the meat of it, which is explaining why that's useful and what you've learned from it.
Mm.
And then my second point was that it's really good when you're going for more of an academic job to actually prepare a body of work. So it's not about just scoring a point, but it's demonstrating a more of a holistic picture. So you, for that one, you don't, it's not about getting one international presentation or national presentation and taking off that entire area. It's saying actually trying to get multiple projects presented in multiple areas. So it's completely opposite advice.
That you gave earlier.
That I gave earlier, absolutely, because it's different context. So, especially if you do a big, one thing which works really well is if you do a bigger project, so like a bigger piece of work, but then you subdivide it into different areas and you present different areas of that at different conferences. That's a very time efficient way to do this. So you can do a very impactful piece of work where you devote a lot of attention to one thing. Whether that's a quality improvement project, whether that's a research project, but then you work out what are your research questions for those things, what are your outcomes, what are the impacts, and then work out where you can present that in different places, and you can get sort of 2-3 sort of presentations or publications for one piece of work.
Jossie?
How did I prep the interview?
Yeah.
Well, I prepped for the interview by doing it 3 times.
That's a really, that's good prep.
So I think the thing that I found most useful was knowing what was coming up. So I did it 3 times because I didn't at the end of F2 just for practice. I knew I wasn't going to take the job and I wanted an F3, but I just thought it would be really good practice to do it, and particularly to force me to get my portfolio together. And then I did it during F2, but then decided I wanted a teaching fellow year instead. So then I did it for the 3rd time this year. And actually, because you can look at what's coming up in the stations, but actually knowing how they do those things. So like, I knew that they did a clinical scenario, but I didn't really know what that looked like. But having done it before, I kind of knew how to prepare best for it. I knew that I wouldn't get anything back, which really threw me the first time I did it, because I was expecting them to do what you said, like say the Airways patent, or okay, here's your ABG result, and they just didn't, and they were just blank faces. So that's not really preparing, but just knowing what was coming up, and if I hadn't done it myself before, then talking to other people and finding out what it would be like would be my advice for preparing.
That's what I was going to say. I was warned about them not giving you any feedback in the ABCD station, so I wasn't surprised when they didn't, and I was prepared to ramble.
Yeah.
You'd have been grateful.
Thanks.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, talking to people who've done it before you and checking, because for Obs and Gynae, again, they changed the stations round the year that I was applying from the year before, or some, it was quite new. So I checked on the website a lot as well, and just kind of got, because the, again, Royal College websites are really, they're running the interviews, so they kind of normally put some information about the format of them. So that was really helpful too.
I think for P's, they definitely gave you the station titles.
Yeah.
Wouldn't explain things like they don't give you any feedback, or
yeah,
actually this part is split in two and they'll
no.
talk to you for 5 minutes and then ask you 2 questions.
Yeah. But you at least get the headlines.
Yeah, you know what questions you need to look up.
Mm.
What was the format of your interview, Jossie?
So it's 3 stations. One was your portfolio station, where you give your portfolio in before you start, so they've already had a look through your folder and they just ask you some questions based on it. There was a clinical scenario, which this year was a lot more detailed than it has been the 2 years before, but I much preferred it because you had more clinical details and therefore you can make a better judgment, you can make a better kind of management plan. And the 3rd one was what they call a communication ethics station, I think, which is my least favourite.
It sounded hard.
And the one I've always done, not terribly, but the worst in out of the 3 of them. And they give you a scenario before you go in, which is kind of, I think this year it was someone wants to self-discharge or something like that. And then they give you an additional scenario when you're in there.
Mm.
And that's where all your medical ethics and your clinical governance stuff comes in.
Mm-hmm.
I think my interview was quite similar to yours. 3 stations. The first one was a management station. This is for surgery. So they send you a question way before the interview time. So for me, it was describe a situation in which you had to demonstrate leadership. And then you basically prepare a 3-minute oral presentation, but without any visual aid. So basically you talk at the interviewers for 3 minutes. And then after that, they ask you questions. So there's a bit of an element of pre-preparation and a bit of an element of thinking on the spot.
Question.
Mm.
Are you allowed to use hand gestures?
Yes, and I used a lot of them, like I'm doing now.
Nice.
And then the second station is the portfolio station. Similar to IMT, you give in your portfolio at the very beginning of the interview. So when you're in your management station, they take your portfolio from you. They look through it, and then by the time you come around to your next station, they've seen it already, and then they start asking you questions about your portfolio. And the whole trick for that station is to explain, like what Phil said, what you've gotten out of the experiences that you've evidenced in your portfolio. So don't just describe them because they're all there, but show actually what have you learned about this experience, what have you learned about yourself through this experience, and how is that going to make you a good like core surgical trainee. And then the last station was a clinical scenario. So they give you a piece of paper with a little brief outside the station. You get about 5 minutes to read through it and think about your answer. And then you talk about that clinical scenario. And then when you're in there, you get another clinical scenario which you haven't had time to prepare for or think about. So again, it's an element of seeing how you think on your feet. And then that's it. That's the whole interview.
Cool. So just our last question then. What is, maybe just briefly going around, what is one thing that you wish you had known before you had applied? Hamida.
I think I'm going to cheat. I'm going to do 2 things.
That's cheating. I don't know why I just said what you just said.
You confirmed it.
I confirmed. You are cheating.
So
10 marks.
The first thing is the portfolio takes a lot longer to put together than what you think. So I thought, you know, I've got all these pieces of evidence. I know exactly where they are. All I need to do is just print them out and put them in a poly pocket and put them in a folder, finished. No. So even getting together all your evidence, making sure it's formatted correctly, and then organizing your folder, which is, it sounds a bit trivial, but it's actually a major part of the portfolio station, and it's something that you do get points for. All of that takes a lot of time. And then you'll realize you've got maybe too many things, or you've missed out something, or you want to add something in. So just get started with that early, and it helps you prompt your thinking about what you're actually going to say in the station, and prepare yourself for the talking bit of that station. And then my second thing is you don't have a very long time between sort of like the end of a post and then the time you have to apply for interviews. So for example, if you wanted to start core surgical training after F2, say you finish F2 in August, your interview is going to be in November. So make sure you know what you need to get done, you know, what your weaknesses or like areas of improvement in your interview or portfolio are, so that you can actually do the projects in time before your interview, because it does come around really quickly. I wish I'd known that.
That's good advice, because I think it's good just to like start thinking about interviews in summer, like sort of June, July, and if you start inquiring then you won't get caught out.
Shall I make you feel better and do 2 as well?
Mm-hmm.
The first one, I wish I'd realised that doing Bill looks really cross.
It's not okay.
That when it comes to the actual interview, one of mine's not a real thing. When it comes to the actual interview, being early is being on time, and being on time is late, because I arrived a few minutes early thinking I was fine, and I think I was the second to last person to arrive, which made me feel anxious. It didn't matter, but everyone had been there for like half an hour, chatting and drinking water.
Nervous peeing.
Yeah.
And that's one point actually. You get a really dry mouth in the interview, so drink water between the stations. But the second thing is that 3 a.m. is not the time to feel the need to check your random poster title from your intercalation, because I woke people up by panicking at 3 a.m.
Yeah.
Just chill and sleep.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Abby?
I have one, promise.
Good.
Good.
Someone finally listening.
I think the main thing that I wish I'd known going into the interview was, this sounds really antisocial, but don't speak to anyone at the interview. I didn't. Well, I did. I fell into the trap of speaking to them after the interview. So the three girls who kind of been on my like station circuit, I'd kind of kept my head down, not kind of spoken to anyone, not got like too psyched out or anything by everyone in all their fancy clothing. And then on the way out of like our station, they descended and it was not helpful and it really stressed me out. And they started talking about stuff that they'd said and stuff that they'd done. And then one of them was like, I mean, I mentioned in the interview that I had a PhD. And I was like, ha! I was just like, and all of my little, like, my poor little audit and my poor, like, my months in New Zealand, I was like, she's got a PhD in obs and gyne. Like, what am I doing here?
My audit was asking a woman how her birth was.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, why do I even bother? So I just wish I'd kind of stuck my guns and just, I mean, obviously if you see a mate, say hi to them, don't be rude. But like, I just wish that I'd stuck to my guns, just kept my head down and just been in, stayed in my lane, because it just, it stressed me out and it was unnecessary. And actually, got my job and everything was fine.
So you got the job you wanted, so it didn't matter that you didn't have a PhD.
Yeah, I wasn't going to say that, but I did. But yeah, it didn't matter I didn't have a PhD. It really makes no odds whatsoever. But for about a good 3 weeks post-interview, it felt like it really did. So I think that's my best advice.
I think mine would be the same as Meaden, that I didn't realise how long it was going to take to get everything together. I thought, oh, it's all on my computer somewhere, it won't take long. It took so long to find it all. I had to find a good printer to print it all out in colour, and you have to order it, and you have to buy an extra wide folder, buy an extra wide divider, so you have to make sure the plastic pockets are nice and shiny. And then for the medicine ones, I don't know if you have to do the surgical one, you have to number it.
Yeah.
So then I had to number it to like page 98.
Yes, exactly.
It took weeks.
Yeah.
So start early.
Yeah.
And also, if you're not applying, still put it together at the end of foundation, because people will move on, consultants will move on, you will not have proof and you will need it from them, and you will lose their email addresses or they'll go elsewhere.
Yes.
So if you're applying for IMT, make your portfolio in F2, even if you're not applying in F2.
Yeah.
What are these jokers doing?
I'm the only one who's
unsolicited advice.
You asked.
One point, thank
that
you.
That was one point.
I've got one more piece
of advice.
He said
also. No, three.
I've got one more.
No, my point was, the also was an extra point within my original point, which was make you do your portfolio.
Sub point.
Early.
I've got a really important one.
We can split hairs in that one afterwards. Yeah, go for it.
Follow instructions.
like make
at the
make one point.
Follow the instructions.
Follow instructions. Great.
Yeah.
Well, mine is less about the interview. Mine's just...
Have you done yours already?
No.
No, he was
so
just
long.
Chatting.
Yeah, no, that was your 5 points.
Come on, I'm just trying to be like Phil for once in my life.
Okay. Anyway, so mine would be actually just be aware of what opportunities are out there which you might not have come across. So I didn't find out about the ACF until I went to a medical education conference in the summer before I applied. I wish I'd known about it earlier, because I think it would, I don't know, I think I was a bit stuck at that point in terms of what I even wanted to do, and so it just helped me point in the right direction.
Yeah.
There's my one point.
Lovely.
Wonderful.
Point.
It's a great point.
Really enjoyed that point.
Thank you.
My fave.
Thank you. Cool. So just to round up then, something else I was thinking about while we were chatting, and this is not to do with the last question, but is that if you are not sure what you want to do and you're not sure how to sort of whether you split between different choices, it's good to keep your options open, but just to pursue the things you enjoy, pursue things you love, and you don't know, maybe you'll find that actually you find opportunities in that area, but do things you enjoy and don't try and just jump through hoops for the sake of
mm-hmm.
jumping through hoops if you don't know what you're doing that for, and try not to close doors before you have to,
unless those hoops are going to EARCP and then jump through them.
Yeah. Unless they're critical for your continual career as a doctor.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for hanging with us today. This has been Contingency FM.